This is Jim Fenter, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Today, my special guest will be Judy Wood, who is an expert in various fields directly related to the study of 9/11. I'm going to be posing to Judy a couple of dozen questions, the kinds of questions that seem to be raised as forms of objection to her research on 9/11. It should be very informative, especially for those who really haven't got a handle on a position that is sometimes derisively described as star beams or rays from space hypothesis, which needs to be understood in relation to the relevant evidence. Before we turn to my guest, however, I want to read to you a report that was posted today on prisonplanet.com, which is an Alex Jones website, which seems to me to be quite striking and important and on the order of eyewitness evidence at the time. It's entitled Ground Zero EMT. We were told Building 7 was to be pulled. New Jersey emergency medical technician asks, how could someone have rigged all these explosives? Before towers collapsed, support columns had been blown out. Paul Joseph Watson, Prison Planet, Thursday, February 8, 2007. A New Jersey EMT has gone public on how emergency workers were told that Building 7 was going to be pulled before a 20-second demolition countdown broadcast over radio preceded its collapse. The Ground Zero rescue worker also blows the whistle on how he witnessed multiple underground support columns of the WTC towers that had been severed before the buildings imploded. In a letter to Loose Change producer Dylan Avery, the individual who wishes to remain anonymous, referring to himself only as Mike, age 30 of New Jersey, describes how he has repeatedly tried to alert numerous authorities to what he saw on 9/11, but was ignored or told to shut up on every occasion and ultimately fired for disorderly conduct. The EMT now dismisses the official government explanation of events and slams the 9/11 Commission as a whitewash. Having been in his profession for 6 years, the individual states that he was at Ground Zero before, during, and after the collapse. He was forced to flee from the falling towers and take cover under a bus shelter as debris rained down all around him, leaving his lungs poisoned today with the toxic dust that 9/11 heroes were exposed to as a result of a cover-up on behalf of Condoleezza Rice and the EPA that assured workers Ground Zero air was safe to breathe. The EMT made the decision to make his claims public after becoming aggrieved at how 9/11 debunkers were viciously attacking the creators of Loose Change for questioning the events of 9/11 in their film, which has now aired on numerous international television stations and has been seen by millions on the Internet. In his enthralling testimony, the EMT goes into graphic detail of how he and others personally witnessed a plethora of explosions at all points of the buildings before their collapse. There were explosions, there were flashes, there was molten metal running down the I-beams of the basement levels like lava flows. I've never seen anything like it. Yes, planes hit the building. Anyone who says otherwise is a moron. But the explosions, the rapid symmetrical sequential explosions, they happened, states Mike. He explains how he and others were in the basement of one of the towers helping injured victims when he saw one of the huge steel and concrete support pillars with an eight-foot section blown out of the center of it. Looking around, Mike saw other support columns that were in the same condition, prompting rescue personnel to ask, how could someone have rigged all these explosives? We stood outside listening to the explosion, states Mike, one after the other every minute or so, at one point about 10 minutes before the first collapse. A 30-foot or so section of the courtyard exploded straight up into the air. Just before the collapse is a series of deep below-ground explosions, then numerous explosions in the building's upper floors. Then we ran. We felt the same deep explosions before the second collapse. This was not just the planes. The rescue worker concludes emphatically, the buildings were rigged, there is no question about it. Perhaps of even more interest, the EMT relates the fact that hundreds of emergency rescue personnel were told over bullhorns that Building 7, a 47-story skyscraper adjacent to the Twin Towers that was not hit by a plane, yet imploded symmetrically later in the afternoon of 9/11, was about to be pulled, and that a 20-second radio countdown preceded its collapse. Following news report in the days after the attack that Building 7 had collapsed due to fire damage, Mike fully expected this mistake to be corrected after the chaos had subsided, but was astonished when it became part of the official story. Questions about Building 7 came to the fore in January 2004, when footage of WTC complex owner Larry Silverstein telling a September 2002 PBS documentary that after consultation with the fire department in New York, the decision was made to pull the building, surfaced on the Internet. These issues were subsequently explored in Alex Jones' Martial Law and Terror Storm documentary films. Since then, debunkers in Silverstein's office itself have tried to argue that Silverstein simply meant to pull or evacuate the firefighters out of the building. Yet in the same documentary, explosives experts are seen demolishing the remnants of other buildings in the Ground Zero area and repeatedly use the industry term pull to describe a controlled demolition. In addition, there were no firefighters in WTC 7 to pull in the first place. Dr. Shyam Sunder, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which investigated the collapse of WTC 7, is quoted in Popular Mechanics in its article 9/11 Debunking the Myths, March 2005, as saying, "There was no firefighting in WTC 7. The FEMA report on the collapses from May 2002 also says about the WTC 7 collapse, "No manual firefighting operations were taken by Fire Department New York." In an article by James Glantz in the New York Times on November 29, 2001, says about WTC 7, "By 11:30 a.m., the fire commander in charge of that area, Assistant Chief Frank Fellini, ordered firefighters away from it for safety reasons." Photo and video evidence of the collapse of Building 7 shows classic indications of a controlled demolition. The standard crimp in the center left top of the building and the subsequent squibs of smoke as it collapses clearly represent explosive demolition. Even Dan Rather, commenting on the collapse for CBS News, said that the collapse was reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, where a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down. The ENT worker agrees, saying, "There were bright flashes up and down the sides of Building 7. You could see them through the windows, and it collapsed. We all knew it was intentionally pulled. They told us." On February of 2002, Silverstein Properties won $867 million from industrial risk insurers to rebuild on the site of WTC 7. Silverstein's Properties' estimated investment in WTC 7 was $386 million. This building's collapse alone resulted in a profit of about $500 million. Due to the many unanswered questions surrounding Building 7, the National Institute of Standards and Technology was forced to include in its probe of Building 7 the theory of whether hypothetical blast events could have played a role in initiating the collapse. Following the attacks, Mike made a sustained effort to inform the relevant authorities of what he saw, including the New York Fire Department, the New York Police Department, newspapers, and television networks. In every case, he was told to shut up, forget about it, or let it go for my own good. Initially praised as heroes when Mike and his colleagues tried to go to alert their EMT coordinator in charge of what they had witnessed, they were brought up on charges of disorderly conduct, fired, and fined for damaged uniforms and equipment they had used on 9/11. Two other colleagues who witnessed the same events now refuse to even acknowledge they were at Ground Zero for fear of reprisals. Stand by. We'll be here with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin on Mondays and Fridays. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood. Judy may be the most controversial figure conducting research into 9/11. But in my estimation, she's also the single most qualified, which raises very interesting questions about why the single most qualified individual studying 9/11 should also be the most controversial. Among her degrees, for example, are ones in civil engineering, in engineering mechanics, and in materials engineering science. Exactly the kind of background that would perfectly qualify someone for undertaking an analysis of, for example, what happened in New York to the World Trade Center. Judy, in collaboration with Morgan Reynolds, has been putting together a quite elaborate website that is documenting the extent of the devastation that was brought about that day and has been offering hypotheses and conjectures about how it might have been brought about. She has been led in the course of her analysis to consider the possibility that some sort of high-tech directed energy weapon, probably one that emerges as a result of military research in relation to the Star Wars or Strategic Defense Initiative, the project that Ronald Reagan initiated and that Bob Bowman became the scientific director of, to shoot down enemy ballistic missiles, which led to the emergence of all kinds of new technological developments, many of which remain classified to this day. Judy, however, is hardly the first to contemplate the possibility that a directed energy weapon might have been used on the World Trade Center. Jim Hoffman, for example, who's familiar to many students of 9/11, has offered that hypothesis. Webster Tarpley, in his book 9/11 Synthetic Terror, has reported on Hoffman's research and discussed the possibility that directed energy may have been used. And therefore, while Judy and others, including myself, may find it very interesting, even fascinating, as I frequently describe it, to consider hypotheses in this category, it's odd and very suggestive of a certain kind of political agenda among her critics that they seem to have neglected, that others before her have also taken this hypothesis seriously, including persons as well known in the community as Jim Hoffman and Webster Tarpley. Now, it is incidental if Hoffman, for example, may have decided he made mistakes in his research, as Judy has suggested he may have done. The point is that it's a serious hypothesis that serious people have taken seriously, and therefore for her to be faulted on that ground seems to me to be very peculiar, almost certainly politically motivated, perhaps by those who have some concern that this hypothesis may be leading in the direction of a full and complete understanding of what actually happened on 9/11. Now, I have put together a set of a couple of dozen questions that have been raised in the community one way or another that I want to address to Judy to give her a chance to answer those questions and place things in perspective. I'd also mention a terribly important part of her work, to which we will no doubt return, is the section entitled Conclusions on her website. And we'll talk about that, because here you have a nice summary of the principal data that has to be explained, of the alternative theories that might explain it, and how the data and the theories intersect. But before we reach that point, which will be very much on the order of the culmination of our conversation, I want to welcome Judy back to the Dynamic Duo and just tell her I'm delighted to have her here today. Judy?
Hello, thanks for welcoming me back.
Yeah, absolutely terrific. I'm sure you must have found it to be as interesting as I did, this report from this EMT that was put in on Prison Planet today. I think what he has to say about WTC-7 is utterly fascinating. The fact that there was even an announcement over a bullhorn that the building was going to be brought down, that they even had a countdown. I mean, this is just devastating testimony.
I'm aware of that myself, because I recorded from Rabbit Ears television reception that afternoon what was going on. And there would be this little ticker running across the bottom of the screen, which is unusual for Rabbit Ears reception, saying that, you know, Building 7 looks like it's going to come down, and then the little thingy would go away. And a little bit later, you know, half hour later, it would come back again. And it was as though, you know, do they have the wires loose and, you know, it didn't work yet? And
that's terribly interesting. Right on 9/11, you were recording that.
Yes, I recorded that. And
Judy, that's stunning. That's so prescient that you did that. That's wonderful. I mean, when I was awakened, you know, my wife and I were awakened by a phone call from our daughter in Sarasota. I mean, it didn't even cross my mind to record it, and yet that would have been an excellent thing to do.
Different people have emergency response.
Uh-huh.
And mine happens to be data collection.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, so, you know, I don't know what I'm using it for, but I feel like the need to record it. And then I would sample different stations and readjust my antenna so I could get that. And it was happening on the various stations. what was interesting is that after the building did come down or whatever happened to it, they're interviewing a reporter who said that they were handed out dust masks to all the reporters standing around. But then when it came time to actually bring the building down, they took us a block or two back from it for safety.
We're talking about 7?
Yeah. This is what the reporter stated.
Uh-huh.
He said that they handed us out dust masks mid-afternoon in preparation, but then when it actually came time to pull the building, they moved us a few blocks back for safety.
By the way, just for the benefit of our audience listening to me, read this report, this article that's in Prison Planet, that this EMT was in various places has got to be situated with respect to the timeline, because, of course, there was an hour in the South Tower and an hour and a half in the North Tower between the times that the planes impacted with the buildings and the fires were initiated. I mean, assuming that much to be the case. And their actual demolition, so that he had the opportunity to be in the sub-basement level. And when he's talking about massive damage in the sub-basement level, which, of course, is during this hour interval in the South Tower or hour and a half in the North, he's reporting or appears to be reporting the results of massive explosions in the sub-basement of the kind that William Rodriguez had reported relative to the North Tower, and that Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross have substantiated in their comparison of the seismic data with the FAA and radar data, where they have determined that, in fact, Willie was right in reporting that the explosions occurred before the planes hit the building. The explosions in the sub-basement before the planes hit the building as much as 14 and 17 seconds. Stand by. We're going to return with my special guest, Judy Wood, talking about 9/11 research, theories, and evidence. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Judy Wood, who has degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and materials engineering science, which are, in my opinion, the most relevant disciplines or areas of specialization in relation to study of the events at the World Trade Center on 9/11. And I regard her as the single most qualified student who is involved in 9/11 research. Judy, of course, I have sent you, at your request, a list of questions that are popping up here and there in the community, often by persons who really haven't taken an effort to go to your site to look at the evidence or to think these things through.
Correct.
But they seem to be a very desirable way to kick things off in terms of presenting your views in a way that might be very accessible to a wide community. Let me begin with a question that has to do with the title of your website, which was the Star Wars Beam Weapon. I know that's created a lot of controversy, and some people have wanted to play on the use of the phrase. So I just want to ask, by opening number, how did you settle on that title?
Well, first I would like to make a comment. I think most listeners are familiar with all of the attacks going on with my work, and I think that's good news, because there's a quotation I'd would like to read. It says, "The likelihood of one individual being right increases in direct proportion to the intensity to which others are trying to prove him wrong." So based on that, it looks like we're dead center on right.
Well, this is very consistent with Jack White's observation based on his JFK research that the more intensely and viciously you're being attacked, the greater the probability that you're onto something significant. So this dovetails. I tend to agree with that principle based on my now nearly a decade and a half of dealing with JFK research and on Paul Wellstone and on now 9/11. Okay, good. That's a nice preface.
So if they're going to attack, they're going to attack on everything. Anything and everything.
Yes.
And
yes,
you
yes.
mentioned about the title.
Yes. For example, the title. Let's begin there.
Well, the paper started being posted based on the seriousness of it. You know, if you keep secrets, you usually don't live to tell about it. And so based on the seriousness of what we were working on, we felt it was very important to post it as we were working on it.
Okay, in other words, get as much of what you were thinking through out there into the public domain as early as possible.
And work on it in full public view.
Yes.
So there was no reason to silence any secrets.
Yes.
And I think that that has been very healthy for us.
No, I think that's right. You know, there was a final paragraph on this report that I didn't actually have the chance to read from Prison Planet, which I'd like to kick in here. This is the last paragraph. It says, "The astounding testimony of this BMT only adds further credence to the already overwhelming case for controlled demolition of both the Twin Towers and Building 7. We implore this individual to go public with his full name in the interest of his own safety. It is far more secure to blow the whistle out in the light than to remain in the shadows and become another victim of those who wish to see 9/11 truth buried." That's very consistent with what you're saying, Judy.
And if any whistleblowers would like to contact me, I should put up a page very soon on various contacts if they would like to be in touch with someone.
Yes.
Because we welcome whistleblowers. We don't beat them up.
Yes.
But as for the title, so if we haven't come to a conclusion yet, how do we pick a title? We're starting at the beginning of the paper and working through. We're looking at the evidence. So how do we know what the conclusions were? We started off talking about the bathtub, and that was actually the first title, the WTC bathtub. And then it turned into, well, putting the bathtub under protective custody, because we realized that the bathtub was very well protected by whatever, however the ordeal was orchestrated. And then, well, okay, the WTC bathtub, and we started seeing that it had to be some sort of energy beam and beam weapon. Well, where would a beam weapon come from? Ah, Star Wars program. Well, we don't need to point fingers directly if we just name it that. Well, that was a real long title.
Well, of course, even the phrase beam weapon, you know, raises lots of opportunities for attempted ridicule, particularly by those who are oblivious of the technical developments in this domain. I myself, as you know, have suggested that directed energy would have been a good title that might not have invited that kind of criticism.
I beg to differ with you. You ask the average Joe on the street, average grandma, whomever, if they've heard of the Star Wars program. For 30 years or so, they've been feeding their tax dollars into it. I think everybody in this country has heard of the Star Wars program, not the Strategic Defense Initiative, but Reagan coined the term Star Wars program. And so everyone has heard of that. It's been around. So, scratch your head. What are they doing when they're developing things in the Star Wars program? Versus energy beams or directed energy, what's that? Now, that's futuristic sci-fi stuff for the average Joe on the street, perhaps.
Like Star Wars directed energy weapon?
It starts being a longer name, and it doesn't really matter that much on the exact title. Attacks are going to happen regardless. They're going to attack the color scheme. They're going to attack anything about it if they want to attack.
Well, you know, something that astonished me, Judy, is when I had my first interview with you. It was my last interview on RBN, which was on Saturday, as I recall. It was 11 November.
Yep.
When I was out in Tucson. And, of course, I was quite fascinated by all the evidence you'd put together of the extent and massiveness of the devastation to the World Trade Center as a totality, because so much attention in the past had focused merely on the Twin Towers and, of course, separately on Building 7. And, of course, my learning really for the first time about the importance of the bathtub as evidence that the extent of the damage, the degree of damage to the bathtub really qualified as a form of evidence regarding how much mass could have collided with that relatively fragile structure. And then, of course, the toasted cars as an add-on was quite powerful evidence to me and convinced me that the hypothesis that was predominant at the time, thermite in the Twin Towers, had practically no potential to explain all of this evidence. Now, because I was having you on and because we wanted to invite attention to all of your research, I've, of course, included a listing of your website, which has, you know, multiple links.
It has evidence.
I was simply stupefied by people reacting to that as though I were somehow thereby, by simply, you know, inviting attention to your website where all this evidence was being collected together and presented, that I somehow had allegedly violated some canons of scientific research, which is, of course, absurd, because scientific research must be based upon all the available relevant evidence, and what you had done was to make available more relevant evidence, which was completely appropriate, or perhaps because of the use of the the lack of the word hypothesis in Star Wars being weapon, it was being alleged that you and I were, you know, prematurely concluding that this was what had been done, when in fact you were at the state of investigating and I was simply encouraging investigating. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays. My special guest today is Judy Wood, and we're discussing 9/11 research, especially her hypothesis that some sort of high-tech directed energy weapon, almost certainly a military origin, may have been used in bringing about the destruction of the World Trade Center. Judy, I was observing that we've been on for several segments, and so far we've been talking about one, you know, the first of several dozen questions. I just want to say I consider all this to be so important that if we do not complete our discussion today, and that appears to be highly probable, I'd be very glad if you could come back on Tuesday and we'll continue our conversation.
Okay.
That would be terrific. Then that way we won't feel rushed, because I think, you know, an awful lot of these questions need to be kicked around this way and that, just so we can, you know, stretch the minds of our listeners to wrap around them so that we all have a common understanding.
Obviously, there's more to the paper than the title.
Of course. Oh,
the document.
Yeah, and of course, you're still completing it, and I think the part on entitled Conclusions is especially an important, and assuming that we don't make
there's just the tentative conclusions as well. But
well, that's the nature of science. All conclusions in science are tentative and fallible. Tentative means they're subject to revision with the acquisition of new evidence, or the discovery that old evidence is flawed or manufactured. Or when you introduce new hypotheses, it may require a reassessment of the relative likelihoods as measures of evidential support of the different hypotheses viewed as causes in relation to the effects, where you calculate the probability of those effects if the hypotheses were true and use that as a basis for comparing them in relation to the evidence. So absolutely all scientific research is tentative, and that yours should be tentative is precisely appropriate given its scientific character. And, of course, fallible, meaning that even the best supported hypothesis in science might turn out to be false, which we can discover in some cases with new evidence and new hypotheses. So that's perfectly characteristic of the history of science, which records innumerable hypotheses that were superseded. Think of the history of astronomy, and the succession of views about the Earth being the center of the universe, and then whether the Earth goes around the sun, and whether the Earth rotates on its axis, and all that. I mean, it should be, you know, I wish it were the common heritage of every American, but a lot of Americans haven't really ever studied the history of science. But your point is impeccable, Judy. Now let's turn to some of these questions. And the first, no doubt, is whether or not your star beam or space ray or whatever, remember all these phrases that can be introduced that are intended to belittle it, are these is your star beam or space ray hypothesis testable?
It's interesting that the focus is attempted to be removed from the evidence, from the data. And what we're presenting is the data, the evidence. And if anyone can come up with a better explanation for this evidence and this hard evidence and data, please, you know,
let me put it this way, Judy. This, you know, what you're implicitly saying is that different causes are going to have different effects, and that by looking at the effects and comparing them with the possible causes that brought them about, you establish testability. This is something that an awful lot of even students of science don't seem to understand that, you know, it's not that you have to be able to always observe a cause. Take gravity. You can't observe gravity. Gravity is an invisible force. And yet you observe the effects of gravity and draw an inference to the existence of gravity. And no one, I think, is going to be disputing it today. And it's similar in the areas like electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear forces. Inferences are made to the existence of forces that aren't directly observable. Now, in the case of directed energy weapon, presumably the weapon itself has got a causal mechanism in a physical location and might be observable. And if you were in the appropriate position to observe it, you noticed, you had remarked in the course of your study that you had discovered that a low-intensity laser had been used in an experiment as far back as 1991, where it was situated on Earth, but you detected by a mirror on a satellite in space back to Earth, and yet hit within about 3 feet of its intended target. That's an extreme degree of precision, but of course is entirely possible because of principles of physics that guide, you know, a laser projection in straight lines highly calculable mathematically with a great degree of exactitude.
You're getting ahead of things. We're still back on the data and the evidence and figuring out how to explain it. But what we have done from looking at the data is we can eliminate certain things, and that's all we've done thus far. We haven't been speculating on exactly what happened.
No, I know, Judy, but the point I'm making is that the evidence allows you to eliminate hypotheses because the evidence reflects effects that those hypotheses as causes could not bring about. I mean, that's the way you do it.
Correct.
You have a class of effects which have only a low probability on a given cause, but a higher probability on an alternative cause, then the hypothesis that confers the higher probability on the evidence, if the hypothesis were true, acquires thereby a higher degree of evidential support. That's the point I'm making. There's an awful lot of lack of understanding about the nature of testability. Testability implies the capacity to acquire evidence whose presence or absence, or if it's testimonial, whose truth or falsity would make a difference to the truth or falsity of the hypotheses under consideration. In this case, there's a tremendous amount of evidence whose presence or absence makes a difference. I mean, you've got it documented in copious quantity on your website with all these photographs of the devastation of the World Trade Center, not just buildings 1 and 2, but 3, 4, 5, and 6, leaving 7 separate and aside, where I think we have now overwhelming evidence, even before this EMT stepped forward, that number 7 was a controlled demolition and, of course, happened in the afternoon, and there's a whole separate matter where it's causation, its explanation, I think, is...
And we do address Building 7.
But yeah, but I mean, the point I'm making is that it's a different
category.
Its destruction is well established. I don't think anyone in the community is going to argue about whether or not 7 came down by a controlled demolition.
Correct.
You know, after Larry Silverstein said, pull it, which is contextually extremely interesting.
Yeah.
And that there was a countdown, according to the CMT. To me, it's just an absolutely stunning revelation. So
right.
I mean, the point I'm making is you, when you talk about being able to eliminate some hypotheses on the basis of the evidence, it's because the evidence reflects effects that could not have been produced by those hypotheses interpreted as causes.
Right. So they've been tested and found that they failed the test.
Right. And some examples would be that you would exclude because they can't possibly produce these effects would include...
Oh, BB gun?
BB guns? Okay, that's fine. Just as an illustration. Go on.
Yeah, I don't think anyone could see that, for example, a slingshot could knock down a quarter-mile-high building.
Good. Although those are trivial examples,
correct.
You work toward more non-trivial, such as, for example, earthquakes or hurricanes.
I don't believe we had a hurricane that day.
Right.
And we can look and see that things didn't blow very, very strongly. I think maybe it was a 5 mile per hour wind that day.
Well, you can see the smoke, of course, being blown, but it doesn't look like it was a very strong wind. That's very good.
Correct.
And, of course, arson doesn't look as though this was a result of arson. And, of course, we know no steel structure, high rises, have ever completely collapsed as a result of fire in the past, arson or otherwise.
But there is no evidence of fire.
And the what evidence there was of fire was extremely limited on the upper portions of the buildings. They were very modest fires.
Yeah, for
the estimates have that they didn't get for the most part over about 500 degrees Fahrenheit, far below even the temperatures that had been certified by the underwriters' laboratory of up to, say, 3 or 4 hours at 2,000 degrees before the structural capacity of the steel would be destroyed or severely damaged. I mean, I've heard estimates that at some temperatures around 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit that it might begin to weaken or lose half its carrying capacity, but these were massively redundant structures that could carry, I've heard calculations, as much as 10 times as their presumption.
Correct. And even if one floor completely melted, that doesn't answer why the other floors would have melted.
Absolutely correct. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is the Dynamic Duo with your host, Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood. We're having a conversation about her research in relation to 9/11 and the destruction of the World Trade Center. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, if we don't complete our conversation today, which is highly likely, then I will look forward to having Judy back as my guest next week. And who knows, Judy, we might need more time even than Tuesday will avail. Let me back up a second, because right at the end we were rushed and I think some figures got a bit garbled. Let me offer a couple numbers about temperatures and so forth, and you can confirm them and so forth, which is my understanding, of course, is that structural steel has a molecular structure that's a combination of iron and carbon. Those are the principal elements. And that in this case, that the structural steel that was used in the building had a melting point of approximately 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit, which I typically round off to 2,800 Fahrenheit. That the fires didn't reach temperatures above, for the most part, around 500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is obviously overwhelmingly too low to cause them to melt, and although there were a couple of areas where there were recorded temperatures in the 1300 and 1400 degree Fahrenheit range, that for the most part they were much lower and of course oxygen starved, and indeed under ideal conditions jet kerosene based fires only obtain a temperature of around 1800 degrees when they're force fed pure oxygen, and of course the billowing black clouds were indicative of an oxygen deprived fire that didn't come anywhere near that temperature. And perhaps most importantly, Underwriters Laboratory had certified the buildings, the steel used in the buildings, up to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours before it would even significantly weaken. Now, that's my understanding. There's been a complaint made that actually Underwriters Laboratory doesn't certify the steel because instead what they do is test the assemblies. But as I pointed out in response, the assemblies are made out of steel, so obviously they are testing the steel in the form of the steel combined in the assemblies. Are these basic figures approximately correct?
Correct, but it's kind of a moot point because when steel heats up, it starts to sag and it droops and it turns into taffy as you keep heating it.
If it were to get sufficiently hot. But, of course,
right,
the temperatures indicated it didn't get anywhere near the temperature of that.
But what we saw was a building that shattered.
Yeah.
Cause the building to shatter.
Oh, I quite agree completely that if the, you know, not only did the fires not come anywhere near, even the maximum temperature with a jet fuel based fire would be 1,000 degrees too low to cause the steel to melt. It didn't even get up to 2,000 degrees where it would significantly weaken after, say, 3 to 4 hours by Underwriter Laboratory certification. But that if it had weakened it would have sagged. It would have been very asymmetrical. It would have been gradual. You would have had a completely different experience with regard to what was going on in the buildings, and the evidence reflects. That's an impeccable point.
A pop quiz I used to give my students, where you get a bunch of old metal coat hangers, wad them up to make kind of a grill to cook your food, or cook a pot of water over a campfire.
Right.
Now, envision getting a pot of water, putting it on these coat hangers, and lighting the fire. As the fire heats up and starts to heat up the water, what's going to happen? And I give them multiple choice. One of the choices is nothing. Another choice is the pot slowly starts to sag, you know, move downward as the coat hangers start to deform. Another one is that the coat hangers suddenly, without notice, shatter into straight little segments that fly in all directions. Or the coat hangers suddenly turn to powder and the pot slams to the ground.
Well, that's nice, because that's getting at the gross properties of the evidence. You know, when the claim is made that there's no evidence for hypotheses that something other than conventional demolition or the fires and the planes and all that brought all this about, I'm just stupefied, because you have this massive evidence before your very eyes, including, of course, the enormous cloud of very fine dust that is the result of the pulverization of the concrete and the steel and the office furniture and the chairs and the computers and the living things, including human beings. Those are all being turned into small particles of dust.
Right. Ankle-deep dust is just filling the streets. And, man, they were fast at cleaning that up. That was amazing. The streets were hosed down and scrubbed by the next day.
Let me ask you a question about these reports of explosions. I've just received an interesting email from Russ Gerst, who's perhaps listening, perhaps not, but who had noticed in this report from Prison Planet that this one paragraph is kind of striking. And it bothered me when I read it, too. There were explosions. There were flashes. There was molten metal running down the I-beams of the basement levels like lava flows. I've never seen anything like it. Yes, planes hit the building. Anybody who says otherwise is a moron, but the explosions, the rapid, symmetrical, sequential explosions, they happen. Now, half of this is reasonable, and half of it may be not, leaving aside about the issues of planes, which is, in my opinion, a rather sticky wicket. Just this talk about molten metal running down the I-beams of the basement levels like lava flows, Russ was observing. He raised the question, what I-beams? I thought they were box columns. Was he talking about 7 or the towers? He wasn't in the basement of 7, so we'd have to infer that it was towers. But what I-beams? I thought this was very peculiar and odd. Now, we have a tremendous number of reports of explosions. You know, all those first responders,
right.
Judy, we see them all over the place in the DVDs talking about boom, 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 boom. There's an enormous amount of discussion of that, which seems to me has to be integrated with a general theory, you know, that we have to be able to account for those explosions. But what's your take on this report from this guy, Mike, 30 years old from New Jersey? I'm just wondering if we have something that's blended in here.
Jim, I think it's very important that we not attack people who come forward. We can weigh it out later. We can look at, you know, what he's saying. Does it coincide with what somebody else is saying? But for interrogating somebody and, you know, picking every detail to death, we're not going to have other people coming forward.
Oh, I agree with that completely, Judy. I was wondering, and Russ was wondering, whether this would have been perhaps added into his report. Maybe this wasn't a part of his original. Now, I can't, you know.
As we talked about in our paper when we started writing, is that there's various kinds of data. There's, you know, eyewitness data. There's recollection, you know, a month later type data. That's, you know, notes taken on that day versus notes taken a month later. Then there's photographs, there's videos, then there's physical objects. The best data I can think of is that the towers are not there.
Yes.
The towers aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
They went away. Okay, we all agree on that.
Yeah.
And then we move from there as to what data everything else agrees with, because we can still go test that. We can go back to the site and see, nope, towers still aren't there.
Yeah.
So good. And as for eyewitness testimony, it is, especially as time goes on, it may change, not because a person is saying something different or remembering something different, But our minds aren't as good as photographic evidence. And, for example, there's someone I know of who works at the Pentagon, who a personal friend of the family's, who came running home from work that day, terrified, they swear that they saw the plane hit the Pentagon and tear they saw the wing tear the roof off of the Pentagon. They honestly believe that. Now, why? There's a whole lot of complex issues that happen and how people record things mentally.
And, of course, the roof only came off the Pentagon some 20 minutes after the plane hit it, so that doesn't appear to be a possible scenario. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood, and we're discussing 9/11 research. Judy, if you caught that commercial, it was talking about shattering...
Oh, yes. I'm glad you picked up on that, too, about resonant frequencies.
By a certain resonant frequency. And I have heard, of course, hypotheses that something like that might have been going on with the World Trade Center. So, I mean, there's another hypothesis. I think that an awful lot of the audience might not realize how hard it is to come up with hypotheses in the first place. So that's really the most challenging part of science, because once you get an hypothesis out there, you can start kicking it around, derive consequences that must be true if the hypothesis is true.
But let's go back to the data, and that's where it all stems from. See, I came to the idea of some type of energy weapon, whether it's from sound or from light or from microwave or whatever kind of energy it was. I wasn't so much concerned with that, but I concluded that it had to be an energy weapon before I even knew that such a thing existed.
Yeah, I think that's highly responsive to, you know, let me now group some questions so we can move through sets of questions and you can, you know, answer them as you think appropriate. Here are the questions. Why do you think we need it, you know, a starbeam hypothesis for 9/11? What can't we explain without it? Don't the reports of explosions undermine it?
Why would the reports of explosions undermine it? Explosions, as being the primary cause, have been ruled out.
Elaborate on that.
Well, for one thing, it would then lead to a gravity collapse. If you use explosions, because I don't think you could have enough explosives in there to pulverize the entire building.
Yes.
So if you're breaking the building up into bits, like traditional controlled demolition, where it's to use a gravity collapse, there wasn't enough time for the building to hit the ground, and there wasn't enough material left on the ground after the job was done.
Well, I think that's terribly important to emphasize. I mean, just make that case again, Judy. I think an awful lot of our audience needs to understand what you're saying right now.
That if the buildings went away, we all agree there, and they went away in times between 9 and 11 seconds, according to the official report. I'm not going to nitpick on how long it took, because that's
Let's just use 10 seconds on the average.
And 10 seconds moving in air isn't enough time for something to go from the roof to the ground with air resistance, much less building resistance.
Right, because you're actually following the path of greatest resistance, not the path of least resistance. The whole collapse theory the government advances is physically absurd.
There isn't enough energy to break the building.
And there isn't enough energy present to break the building apart. That's what Paul Craig Roberts has observed about the government's account. It suffers from a massive energy deficit. But what you're saying is going beyond the government's account, even if we assume the building was laden with lots of explosives. And I notice in this piece by Steve Jones, it's in 9/11 and American Empire, he suggests 3,000 pounds of RDX-grade linear-shaped charges would be sufficient in each tower to cut the supports at key points so that gravity would bring the building straight down. But that reinforces the point you were making, namely that the use of explosives would be consistent with a gravitational collapse, and yet we have contraindications that it was not a gravitational collapse because the buildings disappeared too fast, faster than gravity would have permitted them to come down, and then the mass that should have resulted in terms of debris, just, you know, hundreds of thousands of ton of it, is not present.
Correct. The rescue workers walked horizontally and rappelled down into the sub-basements to look for survivors. They did not climb up.
And then, of course, they were stupefied because there were no survivors. In fact, there weren't even any bodies or body parts for the most part.
Correct. And you know, we do try to accommodate all of the eyewitness testimony, and it's something you weigh into the equation. Everything doesn't hinge on it.
Now, your point about explosives here, Judy, seems to me overwhelmingly significant because you're talking about gross features of the phenomenon. You're not talking about subtleties. You're talking about gross features of
Correct.
The destruction of these buildings.
Correct. I'm not saying that the person on the 43rd floor didn't sneeze, and that contributed to it. Or somebody had a firecracker in their desk drawer that went off. No, that's a bit of exaggeration, but there are like the way the top started down, that had to be something with that looked conventional. Otherwise, it would be too obvious. And indeed, we heard explosions, we saw explosions, but that wasn't the whole story.
So you're saying explosions are conventional. Explosives may have been used in the beginning and the end of these.
I don't even know
destruction
the
sequences.
I wouldn't think the end even. I think at the beginning.
Oh, I was thinking the end for the last 20 floors or so. You know, I've sometimes suggested that maybe 80% of the building is decimated using a high-tech weapon, but you leave maybe 20 floors to be brought down by conventional. So
well,
something
even that, we don't even have 20 floors left.
We didn't even have the equivalent of debris from 20 floors.
Yeah, there's no desks, there's no floor pans, there's no file cabinets. There's
yeah.
There's a few steel columns. My favorite picture, I call it the missing wall picture. It's on page 4. If you go to one of the shortcut links at the top, is missing wall.
Yeah, you want to identify how people can get to your website?
Yeah, janedoe0911.tripod.com.
janedoe0911.tripod.com.
And if once you get to there, you'll see some little diagrams you can click on. It'll take you right to that part of the page.
Okay.
And you see the one, I believe it's in the middle.
Okay.
Or maybe it's on the right. Mine's still coming up. It's on the far right. Of the three pictures, you have a police car in the middle. And on the far right, you have sort of like this gutted out building with a big crater in the middle of it. Just click on that picture, and it'll take you to that to page 4, to that part of the page, where you see that there's nothing much left of Tower 1. Tower 1 is on the far right. In the middle, the thing with the big hole in it, is Building 6, originally 8 stories tall. And on the left, you see the rubble from Building 7. The rubble from Building 7, and even Building 6 is 8 stories tower over the rubble, over the remains of Building 1. There's just some outer walls there. Just a few. So we're missing 100 stories of building.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. And Judy, I look forward to extending our conversation next week. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. With my special guest, Judy Wood. And we're talking about 9/11 research and her Star Wars beam weapon hypothesis, which has become the center or focus of controversy, notwithstanding that other researchers of 9/11, including Jim Hoffman and Webster Tarpley, have taken the hypothesis that the directed energy weapon might have been involved here seriously. It may be that because Judy actually has the background and qualifications to pursue these issues, and that she is elaborating the evidence in considerable detail of the massiveness of the damage to the World Trade Center as a totality, not to mention, you know, tying it together with reflections about the bathtub, the mass of the buildings, the fact that you cannot have had those massive buildings collapse onto the bathtub without destroying its functional ability to withhold water from the Hudson, which would otherwise have flooded the subways and the PATH train tunnels that go underneath the river to Newark, and not to mention undermining the foundations of buildings in lower Manhattan, which would have been catastrophic, and the toasted cars and so forth. Maybe it's because you're being so persistent, Judy, in emphasizing the evidence that you are being perceived as such a threat.
Correct. It's hard to argue with hard evidence. And hard evidence that, as Stephen Jones always emphasizes, he, you know, really likes to to emphasize hard evidence, so I'm sure that he respects my work for this reason.
Well, we mentioned Steve here, and it's inescapable that we talk about his hypothesis that thermite or thermate or some nanotechnology-enhanced version known as super thermite might have been involved here. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Can't thermite do the whole job? And if thermite could do the whole job, wouldn't it be a simpler and preferable theory?
First of all, no, it cannot do the whole job. Again, we come down to a gravity collapse. It's got that problem with it. And it also has a problem of how do you explain the toasted cars a mile away?
Now, on the 24th or 25th of June last year out in Los Angeles, I approached Steve in the lobby, a conversation just between the two of us, and I asked him in relation to the pulverization, you know, the conversion of the building into this very fine dust, which is such a ubiquitous phenomenon, such a fundamental aspect of what was going on, whether super thermate could be sufficient to account for this. And he told me that it could. And I just, you know, have wondered ever since whether that answer was correct. I mean, it was his answer. Obviously, it's his position. But we aren't taking anyone's views as a matter merely of authority. I mean, he could well be wrong. I talked about the case of Luis Alvarez, a Nobel-winning physicist who offered a report about the Zapruder film that we have sought to replicate and discovered was wrong. Steve Jones could be right about some aspects of his work and wrong about others. I'm very interested in the super thermate business, Judy. Can you illuminate us about it?
Well, it's something that is, I guess, I hadn't heard super thermite before, super thermate before. But I have seen various requests for proposals out there to develop it into an explosive, but it really isn't known to be an explosive. It's been used for a pyrotechnic, like for,
Steve has placed great emphasis on this nanotechnology-enhanced version of thermate called super thermate that has explosive properties as opposed to the incendiary or steel-cutting properties of ordinary thermite.
I get to see where it has explosive properties. It's used for pyrotechnics, like making a fireball look bigger and brighter and redder. But I've yet to see any evidence of it being very explosive to this extent. It may be used as an additive in other things for doing another feature. But you know, what a place to try out something for the first time that's never been demonstrated before.
Well, I would, you know, are we talking about the same thing? Are we talking about the nanotechnology-enhanced version? I mean, it could, of course, have been used in other cases, you know, off in the desert or who knows what, where experiments were being conducted.
True, but I have not seen it demonstrated anywhere.
Do you know? Yeah.
And besides, that would be something that's physically located in the building.
Yes.
It would physically need to be placed in the building.
Yes.
Who knows how much of it would need to be placed? Who
yes.
knows how much energy it would take to do whatever it needs to do? It doesn't explain the toasted cars a mile away.
Among other things. Now, the point I would say that is crucial to what you're saying here is even if 3,000 pounds of something like RDX might be enough to cut the steel, you're then depending on gravity to do most of the work for you. It's like Mark Lejeune, who runs Controlled Demolition Incorporation, has said, we count on gravity to perform most of the work for us. So what we have to do is just get rid of the key supports. Now, for Steve to be appealing to super thermate to perform the explosive task, that introduces a whole new dimension because that goes far beyond simply intersecting the steel beams and the key support columns and so forth with that original 3,000 pounds of RDX.
But even that, if it's a cutter, it cuts. If it pulverizes, it pulverizes. It can't do both, and there's no point in it doing both.
Right, but that's why he explained to me that it was the super thermate that was supposed to have the explosive properties. Now, I wasn't in the position then. I wish I could say I was in the position now to evaluate that hypothesis, but I need to know more about super thermate and its properties.
How did he get a mile away?
I don't want to say it's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, but I worry about hearing an imposing phrase which doesn't have, to coin a phrase, hard evidence to support it.
Yeah, I wonder how it can explain the toasted cars a mile away.
Well, I wonder if it can even explain the pulverization. I mean, I just don't feel I know enough about super thermate to assess. I mean, Steve has made a lot of claims about it, and I just like to know more about it in substantiation of those claims.
Right, and that has not been been shown in any way. But the toasted cars, I think, that's when it really hit me what had to have happened. It's the only explanation how you could get instantly one part of the metal totally obliterated and 1 nanometer over, maybe that's an exaggeration, 3 nanometers over, you have the material still in pristine condition.
You got the cars that are sort of half and half, half almost completely obliterated, half in virtually mint condition.
Or, like there's a particular mail truck where it has a hole in the side. You know, how'd that hole get there? Just toasted through. But the other part is still intact. It isn't like a fireball that came from one direction. It's like particular materials were affected, material components, like engine blocks.
Engine blocks, which, of course, have a high percentage of iron.
For some reason, door handles.
Door handles. Typically steel?
Or a cheap form of it. I'm not sure why, but it's a common theme I've noticed. If, you know, the paint might be bubbled up here or there, but the door handles are always gone.
And, of course, the cars themselves generally are made out of shaped steel, so it can't just be steel, can it? It's got to be something.
There's some things that are affected more than others, and there's it seems like if enough gets affected, then you have spontaneous combustion. But there's something that's very focused on a particular material or a particular materials.
This is extremely interesting stuff. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Judy Wood, who is an expert in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and materials engineering science, and in my opinion, the most qualified person who is studying the events of 9/11, especially in relation to the World Trade Center. Judy, during the break, I did a Google search on superthermate, and it's very interesting. There are only 128 entries. An awful lot of them seem to revolve around Steve's hypothesis, pro and con. I'm getting some indications here that the superthermate is a cutting, just a sophisticated cutting charge. There's one set of studies discussing this that suggests that what we need to look at here is the physics of molecular dissociation, and that there's no known pulverization mechanism which can account for so many unnaturally tiny particles at ground zero as were contained in this very fine dust. So I want to say, you know, it seems to me this is a huge issue.
Oh, yes. And I'm putting the data out there and kind of in your face and kind of persistent about it. And so it doesn't matter what names you call the title of our paper. It doesn't matter what names you call me. It doesn't matter if you videotape me going to the bathroom and put it all over the web. That doesn't change the evidence. It's a distraction away from the evidence.
Sure, sure, sure. I mean, anything whose truth or falsity or presence or absence makes no difference to the truth or falsity. The hypothesis is irrelevant. Let me mention this, Judy. This is very interesting. This is on 911u.org/physics/. There's a very interesting table here comparing the use of plasma that it says is an hypothesis that acquires tens of thousands of degrees temperature, thermate thousands of degrees. And the data, here's the list of data across the top. Too many, too tiny particles in the dust, pyroclastic dust clouds, volcanic-like heat, metal molten weeks later, fires burn for 99 days, and it says under plasma, too many, too tiny particles in the dust, that molecular dissociation under that hypothesis can account for it. Under thermite, there's an unknown pulverization mechanism. With regard to the pyroclastic dust clouds, plasma That's the unavoidable effect, but with thermite, that it's unaccounted for. With regard to molten metal, weeks later, the plasma would require gradual cooling. The thermite requires, well, here it says fancy insulation theory. I don't know what to say about that. Fires burn for 99 days under plasma, despite constant dousing with water, under thermite unaccounted for. Now, this seems to be extremely valuable, that if this is a correct table, that certainly suggests that something much more exotic than thermite had to be going on here, and it seems to be in the plasmoid category, as I understand it. Though I certainly can't claim to be an expert in this area, I'm just fascinated. So I encourage everyone, try this out. Go to 911u.org/physics/ and see what you find there. This looks extremely interesting to me.
Correct. There is a lot of interesting data. Now, I have my own hypothesis about, or speculation, would you call it?
Yes.
Educated speculation about the stories we hear of molten metal.
Yes.
With all of the many stories about the molten metal flowing in rivers, and with all the thousands and thousands of photographs out there, why don't any of them have that in them?
The flowing molten metal.
Yeah, there's no photographs of that whatsoever.
Well, what's interesting there, too, Judy, I think, is, as you pointed out to me, that we do have some photographs, say, for example, of this group of workers looking down, you know, beneath the rubble into kind of a cavern, and it's glowing, and yet if that actually were molten metal, the heat would be so hot that it would be melting the skin off their faces.
Right. Yeah, it looks like they're giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to molten metal.
So something is clearly wrong with that photograph. And, you know, it would seem to me having a group peer into that cavern is non-problematical. And it would probably be effortless to touch, you know, change the collar beneath to make it look as though it were glowing metal.
Or to make that suggestion. There's a guy standing there with bare arms just reaching around in there. And, you know, that's not what someone would do if you have molten metal splashing down around in there.
That's right.
There's also this thermal map that was released. It's very poor quality image.
Yes.
That was released soon after 9/11.
It from shows a satellite.
And it shows that it cooled in a week or so's time. That between, I think it was the 18th and the 26th or 27th, one of those dates, that they have this really hot spot, and then it's completely cooled off a week later. That's questionable as it is, but not only that, where it shows the hottest spot just happens to be where I have a photograph of a guy climbing down a ladder into the basement of Tower 2, standing in a puddle.
Which is rather preposterous, standing in a puddle.
And it was taken 2 days after that other, supposedly the satellite image of the temperature.
Of course, I pointed out to some of your and my critics that, you know, about this, who want to contest my, in your observation, that the functional integrity of the bathtub wasn't compromised, because if it had been compromised, then, of course, since its function was to retain the Hudson River water from flooding, if it had been compromised, then the Hudson River water would have flooded, and if it had flooded and there was all this molten metal, we would have had a massive steam explosion reaction. It would have been stunning.
Right. You can have one or the other.
That's right. You can have the water flooding without the molten metal, or you can have the molten metal without the water flooding. And some of those who have asked, well, how then did we get this accumulation of water in the Pathfrain tunnels? You very astutely observed that it probably came from the fire hoses.
Well, not only that, they determined that. That has been determined. That information is out there. But also, a lot of the damage that did occur to the bathtub occurred afterwards when they brought in the heavy earth-moving equipment. And they said it was just a week or so into bringing that equipment in, they realized pretty quickly that they needed to establish a new set of rules as to what machinery moves when, where, and how.
Because the bathtub was so fragile.
Correct. Like, there was a whole, just another question about other explanations is, how do we get these round cylindrical holes that are void in Building 6, but also in the street? There was one right in the middle of Liberty Street between Tower 2 and Bankers Trust. And moving earth-moving equipment around there, they had to figure out how to fill that hole. Because there was just this round hole, there's just nothing in it, vacant. So imagine that, round cylindrical cutouts. That's hard to explain any other way. If you have any kind of explosive, it's radial. It's not, you know, such a clean cut. cylinder.
Well, I found that fascinating, too. I mean, it's just, it's like an incision was made in the building, and all this mass was simply removed from it. So I've likened it when I lost a kidney back in 1983. I mean, the surgeon cut me open, took out the kidney, and there was that, you know, that hole, the missing mass. I mean, it's like there was a surgical operation on Building 6.
Well, also Building 4. The north wing is almost in new condition. Fairly, just the structural part standing there, but it's just severed off with a nice clean slice, like somebody took out a big surgical knife and cut it off. And the rest of the building is just not there, down to ground level. Building 4 disappeared, the main body of it. But the north tower is there, and it's sliced off with a vertical slice, very, very orderly.
And, of course, Building 3 has that huge gash. I've likened it to, you know,
Paul Bunyan taking his axe
and taking a, you know, mighty slash at it, or at least a super-sized Paul Bunyan.
And where did the material go?
And where did the material go? I know it's absolutely baffling. I mean, it seems to me there are some stunning features of these buildings that are essentially inexplicable on any conventional explosive variation. I mean, whether it's thermite, thermate, or RDX, or HDX, I don't see how it can account for this.
The biggest thing I can see, the easiest thing to see about the explosives is with the toasted cars, you'd have, you know, black and white and shades of gray in between.
Judy, hold that thought. I'm going to bring you back next Tuesday. We're going to continue this conversation. I want to thank you for coming on. We're continuing our discussion of 9/11 research on Tuesday with Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.